Hey, my name's Matt, and I'm at Wing Fling. You're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's very own almost underground magazine radio show.
Thank you, Matt. You almost had it. I mean, close enough. I commend you. Good old Wing Fling of tunes. Good morning. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. There it is. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 760. What we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Be sure to say hello online on Twitter at Outside the Loop is the handle, on Instagram, on Facebook, and you just download the podcast of this show. That would be swell. You can go to OutsideTheLoopRadio.com. If you want to stream the show or wherever you get your podcasts, if it's Apple Podcasts or Spotify, whatever you do, you can get the podcast of this program and, of course, through WGNRadio.com as well. We say good morning to, well, Bob Ferguson is, of course, our engineer. We've got to give some love to Fergie, and Colin Seaman will give love to him, who's the producer. Hi, Colin.
Runner-up of a Wing Fling eating spicy, you know, scorpion wing chicken eating contest. That's me. Runner-up, Mike. Did you know that?
Wait, when were you the runner-up?
It was a year that I did not think I was going to compete, but then it was a beautiful Wing Fling year. I want to tell you that you were there because you were. You're not remembering this.
Did I MC it?
You did.
Wait, I MC because for a while there I was MCing the Wing Fling of Tunes. I emceed one that you were in, and I don't remember this?
Right, and so the grand champion, I forget the dude's name, he was like champion 2-3 years in a row?
Yeah, I think it was Tim. I think that was his name.
He was there, and so I was like, I'm not gonna mess with this guy, he's serious business. And then nobody signed up for the competition, and we was like getting down to it that nobody signed up. And so I was like, I had already eaten a lot of wings, I already had a half full belly, but I decided to go for it, and came in second. Tim beat me, but I still to this day think that if I actually had an empty stomach, I would have done better.
I think you could have done that, Colin. You could have won that. I'm just freaking out that I don't remember. I was there. Are you sure?
Yes, you were. In fact, okay. I'm fairly certain that it was you who gave me the nudge to say, somebody sign up for this, please. Somebody sign up.
There were some lean years there, but it's always a fun time. Then my brother-in-law won one year. He just put down 37 super hot wings. Right. Not recommended. Yeah. Not recommended. He had to exit stage left, but he won.
But he won. He beat Tim.
Yes, he did. He did. I think this guy's name is Tim. It might be Andy. I don't know.
We're going with Tim.
Let's just say it's Tim. It's Tim. Well, okay, Colin, speaking of chicken wings here, there was an article in the Tribune from last week that actually my mom set aside for me, and I went over to my parents' house there in good old Elmwood Park, and my mom gave me this article. She says, I know you love chicken wings, I know you love tunes, and here's an article about both. The cost of chicken wings has gone up because of the pandemic, and Danny Beck, the owner of Tunes, friend of this program, it was quoted in the piece here in the Tribune from Thursday, April 29th, and I actually have a copy of it here. It's nice to have a physical copy of the paper. I'm so used to reading things online. This is nice. I like this. Danny has not raised the prices of the wings at Tunes, although he's cut it close because they basically ran out for like an hour until the new shipment of chicken wings arrive. But apparently, according to this article, places all over Chicagoland are cutting back on wings because the prices have gone up. The demand is there. It's just, producers can't keep up.
I am not surprised because the pandemic has been impacting everything. And I also not surprised because as the weather gets nicer, people want some chicken wings outside. It makes me think that maybe we should start looking into alternatives for chicken wings. What do you think, Mike?
Like, what, the cauliflower wings?
Sure. You could go. There's plenty of substitutes. I love chicken wings. I want to sort of preface this with, yeah, I do love chicken wings, but If they are in short supply, then maybe you supplement where you need to. Try something else. Find a meat substitute or get a different type of meat wing. We can make it through here, people. We can make it through this.
Colin is the silver medalist of the Toons Wing Fling. He put that on his resume now that I'm looking it over. I just have it here, Colin. I always look at your resume each week.
Thank you. I got nothing. Thank you.
Let's talk about the show. We're talking about the Thompson Center and its legacy and its future. It's on the old selling block there. We'll also hear from a local singer-songwriter about a new album that he has coming out. And we'll check in with our pal Steve Krakow for the secret history of Chicago music about a soul band from the 60s called the Fabulous Turks. Raise that chicken wing high. This past Monday, Governor Pritzker, in a statement, gave notice that the James R. Thompson Center is for sale. Located at 100 West Randolph, downtown, across the street from City Hall, it has an incredible atrium. It houses a food court in the basement. It's home to the Clark and Lake L Stop, and it is the Chicago headquarters for state government. Lots of Chicagoans really like the building, and others, not so much. Philip Barish is a writer. He has the cover story for New City Magazine. You can check out newcity.com. His piece is called State versus Jan. The Thompson Center is dead. Long live the Thompson Center. Philip Barish is with us here on Outside the Loop. Philip, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome. So, of course, you're referring to Helmut Jan, the architect who designed the Thompson Center. And we'll get to a little bit about him because you had a chance to sit down with him for this piece, which is so cool. But I just want to emphasize, I mean, people feel very strongly on both sides of the Thompson Center issue. This is kind of like something that divides a lot of Chicagoans, isn't it?
That's exactly right. People have strong opinions about the Thompson Center on either side of the debate. I don't think anybody feels neutral about this particularly aggressively styled piece of postmodern civic architecture. And really, it's a good thing. I don't think that Helmut Jahn goes for bland. And frankly, I don't think that our civic architecture should be able to demand more.
I'm of the mind that I like it. I'm fascinated by it. You know, I remember going there when I was a kid and just totally blown away by the atrium. I mean, you look up when you walk in and it's like you're in a spaceship or some futuristic city. I know
it's nuts.
It is nuts. But I know that there are some practical issues. Like if you work there, I mean, you get that food court smell. There's a lot of sort of neglect that's been going on over the years. And that's been an issue with the Thompson Center as well.
Well, I'll tell you a couple of things. First of all, I think talking about the practical matters of the Thompson Center is, first of all, boring. and second of all, a little misleading, because certainly it's in its own ways inefficient. Certainly it doesn't use space the way that perhaps a contemporary piece of developer cookie cutter architecture might, with every square inch taken up by rentable floor space. But that's the point. Not meant to be efficient. It's meant to be symbolic. And I think the experience that you had there as a kid is shared by so many Chicagoans of all ages who come there and are awed. They stand in awe in this building, the power of its design, the interior volume that is, as you said, really transports you to space. Mm-hmm. And what it's meant to say about American government, American democracy, its relationship to commerce. Look, this is also a building that, even below the food court, the smelly food court that is so reviled, also has public transportation, right? It is fundamentally about public benefit. And I think that's really what this building is about, beyond all of its issues of maintenance or energy efficiency or whatever.
Now, like I said, you had a chance to talk to the architect of the Thompson Center himself, Helmut Jahn. How is he feeling about the sale coming up here?
Well, you know, it was a really interesting story to write because, of course, I spoke with many folks for the story, preservationists and authors, architects, people familiar with all sides of this complex issue that's sometimes about tax credits and sometimes about aesthetic preferences and sometimes really about the generational preferences or tastes that shift over time. But the voice that really I thought was important to bring into the story was the architect, Helmut Jahns. And, you know, like many Chicagoans and people around the world, I have followed Helmut's career for many years. You know, he's kind of a bad boy of architecture. How many architects do you know who are on the cover of GQ, right, wearing a floppy hat and looking fabulous? You know, Helmut's a character.
Right.
And now, you know, he's at an advanced age, though he's still very productive. He's creative. He maintains client relationships. But this building is special to him. And that came through really clearly in my conversations with Helmut, that this meant to him more than any other commission in his life. And that's because the Thompson Center really, I talk about this a lot in the story, its scale, its daring, made him an international figure, not just a successful Chicago architect. More than that, though, I'll say that before the Thompson Center, it was possible in Chicago to build these restrained, classy, modernist buildings that all look like Mies van der Rohe towers. After the Thompson Center, that never happens again.
Yeah.
It marks an end of an era and beginning of a new one. And I think Helmut senses that both personally in his life and in the architectural life of a city. So it's a really meaningful moment.
You also write that he feels that the way the Thompson Center has been administered over the years could have been much better. And we talked about sort of the dilapidation and the smells, but that's something that he sees as a real problem. And that's not necessarily his fault, but that's a problem of how the building was run.
That's right. I mean, I think that's the most open secret about the building is that its state of decrepitude is actually... somebody I spoke with characterized it as active neglect. I love that turn of phrase. Active neglect. Right? It's not an accident that the building is in such shambles, that it's chipping away. It's an act of, you know, kind of deliberate disregard, if you will. And that, you know, that hurts. That hurts for Helmut, I think, and for a lot of us Chicagoans who think of this building as... Again, you know, a certain symbol of architectural advancement, of civic pride, all that stuff. So, you know, it's unfair to blame the architecture for the sins of maintenance.
Chicago has a history of this, right? If you think about some of the public housing projects that the city actively neglected, and then, you know, we sort of point our fingers and say, see, those people that live there, they're letting the place go, when in reality,
for
right,
sure.
it's something that's part of what the city should be doing. So this is really nothing new in this regard, but to the extent that it's happening here is pretty big.
I think you're right. I think it's a familiar story. It's a narrative that we know. And in the case of the Thompson Center, a lot of the conversation now is focused, especially given the RFP released by the state of Illinois this week, it's about passing the building into the hands of an owner who can responsibly steward and update the building. And that's really what folks are being setting their sights on right now, is how to take care of the deferred maintenance, to bring it back up to its, you know, former glory. And unfortunately... Maybe not unfortunately. Maybe this is just what the market condition demands. But that's going to be done by a private owner. The state is unable or unwilling to afford it. Public dollars are scarce and becoming more so. And so a private developer, a private owner, hopefully sympathetic to this design legacy, who has respect for the site, will be able to bring the Thompson Center back. Those scenarios were presented by Helmut Jahn. Some of them were developed in partnership with Landmarks Illinois, a nonprofit group that advocates for preservation. But ultimately, it remains to be seen whether an owner with those kinds of deep pockets and that kind of respect for the building is to be found.
Yeah, I mean, the future of it, preservationists want this building to be saved because they argue that it is historically and architecturally significant. But, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen here. I mean, there's a chance it could be saved, but, I mean, there's also a good chance that it could be demolished.
Hey, don't even talk like that. Let's manifest into the world the outcome that we want to see. No, of course it's fate. I mean, this is what triggered the article in the first place. It's fate is uncertain. And though the Thompson Center has long been, you know, a bane of the state of Illinois' budget, and though almost as soon as it was finished, there were talks about how it's inefficient and how it's a drain on public resources, its state now is truly precarious. You know, we are, you know, seriously looking at a possibility of demolishing a structure. I can't overstate this. I mean, this is a tour de force of postmodernism. There's nothing quite like it in Chicago, perhaps North America.
Well, everyone should pick up a copy of New City and go to newcity.com. It's the cover story by Philip Barish. It's called State versus Yon. The Thompson Center is dead. Long live the Thompson Center. We will see what happens with this building. I like the building. Sounds like you do too, Philip. And we'll see what happens with this. But Philip, thank you so much for talking.
It.
You love it.
I'd marry it.
If that were a thing. Philip, thank you so much for talking to us today. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Though every aspect of our lives was impacted by the pandemic and we had to change our way of life a bit, musicians are still making music, and that is a good thing. Jared Rabin is a musician. He's a multi-instrumentalist, actually. He is based here in Chicagoland, and he has a new album on the horizon called Cold Rain and Snow. You can check out his website, jaredrabin.com, R-A-B-I-N, jaredrabin.com. Jared, welcome to Outside the Loop. Nice to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So here you are, a musician, and you are a prolific musician. I know you're playing a lot, and at least you were before the pandemic, but how have you been surviving as a performer, as a musician, as an artist during this crazy pandemic year that we've been living in?
Well, it feels like it's been such a long time already. Like, how I am now is like so different than it was a year ago, you know? At first, I mean, you know, obviously we haven't been able to perform live for, you know, in our usual manner for the last year. So, I mean, that was the original, you know, kind of devastating thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's been a gradual thing, like figuring out ways to, you know, I've gotten really proficient with live streaming. That was like kind of more in the beginning of the pandemic. I feel like everyone immediately was like live streaming everything.
Yeah, right.
And I was like doing like a Friday night thing for a while on like my Instagram, which was, you know, kind of cool. Yeah, just figuring out different ways to stay, you know, playing, recording, doing something musical since we couldn't do it together, you know, the way we normally do.
Yeah, you know, I know you've been doing some live streaming and playing with people from across the country, and we started to see the rise of this during the pandemic, where you're playing, you know, maybe you're playing guitar in Chicago and someone else is playing bass in Philly and drums in California and putting it all together. And I know you're doing some of that.
Yeah, and it's something kind of like that was happening already all the time, but just wasn't like broadcasted necessarily. You know, that kind of recording happens like all the time with all types of music, like every day, having capability of like home recording and stuff now, happens with like major songs and stuff. But all of a sudden that was kind of like a cool way to like connect with people during the pandemic when you couldn't connect with anyone. You know, I got back in touch with friends, musicians that I hadn't talked to in years. Just cause like they kind of saw like videos I was posting, were like, hey, like let's do one together, you know, or stuff like that. So it was kind of a cool thing.
And you have this new album out, or it's coming out this summer, Cold Rain and Snow. And this is an all acoustic kind of bluegrass originals and some standards album that's coming out in, I believe it's July. Is that right?
Yes. Coming out July 2nd. Yeah, it was all stuff I've recorded at home during that whole past year of being largely at home. Kind of started off just, I was recording the videos we were talking about, just kind of for fun, and started kind of amassing a good amount of tracks, you know, as last fall kind of rolled around. I was like, well, you know, I have enough stuff to kind of like do something with. So, you know, and then I finished up a couple of original songs and kind of tied it together and decided to do a release now that things are looking up and there's possibly, hopefully, some opportunities to perform this summer and stuff.
Yeah, boy, let's keep our fingers crossed. It looks that way, but we want those metrics to stay.
Yeah, yeah, the announcements, the numbers, you know, things seem to be trending the right direction.
Yeah, you're right. I know there's a single that's coming out next week, the single called Hey Mr. Doctor. Tell us about this song.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of that's kind of my ode to the pandemic. It was written, I guess, last summer, kind of in the, you know, it's in the phase when Dr. Fauci was kind of under a lot of, you know, he kind of disappeared for a while. You know, he was on TV for a while in the spring, right. And then he became in the bad graces of, you know, the powers that be, and kind of was off the TV for a while. And I was kind of just thinking about kind of my ode to the good doctor, you know.
Hey, Mr. Doctor, did you know how far they're gonna shove this thing up my nose? Can you tell me when I'll be all good to go? Take a vacation down in Mexico.
Yeah, he came back in a big way, you know?
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, as was needed.
Right, right. So this song, kind of, as you say, your ode to the pandemic. You know, something that's really cool about you, and maybe we don't know this, but you can check it out at jaredrabin.com, jaredrabin.com. You are an award-winning musician. In 2016, first place in the USA songwriting competition. You've been a semifinalist in subsequent years in the international songwriting competition. So that's great. I mean, here you are, you know, doing it on your own, making your music, but you're being recognized for what I think is really great music and sort of that, you know, Americana rock sort of roots vein.
Yeah. I mean, it's those songwriting competitions are kind of, you know, you have to kind of do anything when you're like an independent artist and you don't, you know, you're not like with a label or anything. You kind of have to figure out ways to, you know, stand out from the crowd, get, you know, anyone's attention to notice you in any way. So, you know, I started at some point when I was releasing my own music, entering a bunch of those things and had some success, which is, you know, validating. And also it's been like kind of, you know, it's been a good attention getter, just kind of a way to set you apart from like the 5,000 other songwriters at the same time, you know, doing the same thing as you are.
Yeah, I know the competition is stiff. And I mean, look, in Chicago, the music community is deep and it's expansive. And so, yeah, you've got competition, but, you know, and I love this about the Chicago music community. It is very collaborative. It is very familial.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been doing it in Chicago for 15 years or more at this point, and gone through all sorts of phases. You know, I started coming up through sort of the jam band community and like the jazz community, and you know, now my main gig is playing guitar, playing gigs in Chicago, you know, which hopefully is coming back very, very soon. And so, you know, I'm all across the board. You know, I play with a band most weekends. In normal times, you know, we play weddings and stuff, play all types of music from classic rock to hip hop, and everyone's doing their original stuff too. And yeah, it's just a very, expansive is the right word, because there's still, you know, after 15 years, I still meet people all the time, and, you know, and very collaborative too, in that, you know, everyone's kind of open to, you know, performing together, writing together, all sorts, you know. So, I mean, it's just been, it's been a long journey, many different facets, many different aspects, you know.
Well, congrats on all the success you've had so far. Good luck with a new album. Again, it's called Cold Rain and Snow. It's coming out in July. The single comes out next week. You could check out jaredrabin.com. That's R-A-B-I-N, jaredrabin.com. Jared Rabin is a Chicagoland musician and a multi-instrumentalist. Jared, thanks for talking to us today, and really, man, best of luck going forward.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Occasionally, in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. The strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter the self-quarantine version of
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Like the sunshine, turn on the heat,
Yes, dialing up across town, connecting with the lair of an apartment of Plastic Crime Wave himself, Steve Krakow. Steve, we're getting soulful this week, and we are profiling the Fabulous Turks. The Fabulous Turks. I love this sound.
Yeah, this was a nice sort of unexpected band that, man, just not much documentation on at all. And someone came to me for once. It's like, here's a story you need to tell. And that's always nice when that happens.
Yes, it is. And so you dig into it in The Secret History of Chicago Music. So really, we're focusing primarily on two guys here, Thomas Williams, and who's a singer, and his songwriting collaborator, Willie Weems. That's kind of where the story starts.
Yeah, and it's cool because I got to get the story pretty direct from those guys via Thomas's nephew, RJ Griffith. He just covered one of his uncle's songs, and that's what kind of alerted me to this whole thing, and, you know, sort of sent some promotional stuff to the Reader about it, saying he was covering his uncle, the Fabulous Turks, and was like, who's that? You know, because if you look him up, you don't find too much. But yeah, so we got to get the story directly from the guys, which was really cool.
Yeah, that is cool. So we're talking about the Fabulous Turks and Thomas Williams, born in Tallahassee, Florida in 1943. And he moves to Chicago when he's 3 years old. And he's you know, again, influenced by music at a very early age. And he remembers that as a 13-year-old seeing a performance from an R&B group at a club, which is amazing because you're 13.
Right.
And that kind of sets him on a trajectory here.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he knew that was his moment. They were dressed nice and professional. He's like, yeah, I want to be an entertainer. And definitely was way into Frankie Wyman, from Frankie Wyman and the Teenagers and stuff. And yeah, he had one a little bit earlier group called the Fascinators, which my editor actually did a little digging and, yeah, found out that they actually did sort of squeak out a single. I don't think even Thomas knew this. And it's a whopper. It goes for like a ton of money, but it's rare, you know, on this Bombay label, this tiny label. So yeah, he got a little taste of the biz, and then he sort of joined, you know, and supposedly they're going to roll out the red carpet for him. And, you know, he had all the flashes of it, and it didn't quite happen. So then he joined this little bit bigger band, Fabulous Turks, in the neighborhood.
And so the Fabulous Turks, this is in the mid-60s when Williams joins the band. They were already kind of gigging around Chicagoland, so they had some established following here. And that's sort of the next phase of the story. And that's kind of where Willie Weems comes in.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I said in the strip, you know, in some perfect world, I would do a whole thing on Willie Weems, because he's a really cool behind the scenes guy who, yeah, he wrote for all these people. You know, he said he wasn't a singer himself. He actually was pretty self-depreciating about his own singing, but mm-hmm. he's a great writer. Yeah, and he worked with all these people. He moved up here from Mississippi and lived in Maywood, and he was more like inspired by the blues and such, you know, but soul music as well. Ray Charles and guys like that, R&B, I guess, as they called it, you know, in those days. But yeah, he also wrote a single for Junior Wells. Hey,
yeah, that's pretty cool. Girl, You Lit My Fire.
Right, yeah, which I want to feel like is a response to Light My Fire, especially since it came out in 1968. You know, they used to kind of do these response songs, be like, hey, light my fire, hey, you lit my fire, you know. So I want, and it's a pretty groovy you know, late 60s vibe song too, as well. But yeah, he also wrote for the Fabulous Turks and sort of came in as their writer, as you know, and wrote some pretty cool tunes for him.
Yeah, so he, in 1969, I mean, he's writing some songs for the Fabulous Turks, and in 1969, they release two 45s. He composes them, and what happens with these releases?
Well, not much, sadly. It, you know, it sounds like it got some local airplay here in Indiana and stuff, but supposedly was picked up by like 35 radio stations nationally as well. They got like, I mean, they signed a terrible contract with this label that basically they, four guys were splitting a penny and a half on each record.
Oh.
So, what, you know, that's not even half a penny a guy, really, you know?
Right.
Let alone the songwriter, you know? But, yeah, they basically got out of their contract because stuff was just not promoted. But one very cool thing they did is they played the first Black Expo in 1969, playing with James Brown, Aretha Franklin, B.B. King, and the Supremes.
That's insane.
I mean, that's crazy.
It.
So, I mean, so that's huge. And I have a feeling, you know, they were probably well received on the local circuit, you know, but it sounds like that was a whole different, you know, they played the quote unquote Chitlin circuit of the day. And that sounds like it was rough. You know, it wasn't no Black Expo. This was like people chucking bottles like in the Blues Brothers or whatever, you know. So, you know, like most bands, I think they saw both sides of things.
So what happens to the Fabulous Turks? I mean, they played some good gigs, that really huge gig in 1969 at the very first Black Expo. What ends up happening to the Fabulous Turks?
They pretty much petered out by 1970. I think that brass ring they thought they were going to grab just, you know, wasn't happening. And the reality of like having families and stuff like that sort of set in. But Willie Weems, he stayed with it. He at least till the 80s, he said he's still writing stuff from the interview I saw with him that RJ, the nephew, did. And I guess he's pretty jazzed that, you know, Thomas's nephew, RJ, is covering his song. So his work is still in the public eye as well, you know. So, mm-hmm. yeah, he's, you know. In a way, it's kind of a happy ending, which you don't really get with these stories, you know? I mean, it's like, yeah, they fade out of the biz. Yeah, they never made it. But, you know, the music lives on is kind of the happy takeaway you could take from this, you know?
The music does live on. RJ Griffith's remake of You Turn Me On, it was released in March, and it sounds really, really good. A cool take on an old tune. And you can learn more about the Fabulous Turks in the Chicago Reader and ChicagoReader.com. The Secret History of Chicago Music column is done by Steve Krakow, also known as Plastic Crime Wave. Also, he hand draws a picture of the musician or band he profiles. Steve, I love when we get soulful here on the Secret History of Chicago Music. You stay soulful, brother.
My soul is filled. Like the sunshine.
Yes, the rap party for Outside the Loop show number 760, where Colin and I recap the show a little bit, offer some takeaways, and the Thompson Center. I am pro Thompson Center. I think it's such a cool building. Granted, I don't work there, and I know that people who work there do not like it. Most people that I hear from that I've run into over the years, I still think it's cool. We should find a way to save it and maybe run it, maybe like care about it, you know, instead of tearing the sucker down. Colin, where do you fall on this?
I am torn because architecturally there is just no question it should be saved. It is gorgeous. It's a spaceship to the planet, whatever, but it's really inefficient. It's really got a lot of work because, what was the expression used? Like active neglect. Was that it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's accurate. It's 100% accurate. The stewards of this building have let it decay. And now it is incumbent upon a benevolent billionaire to come in and buy it and turn it around. I mean, those don't really exist, or do they?
No, they don't. I mean, well, they might. You know, there was that guy who wanted to buy the Tribune and save it from its impending doom. He seemed nice, at least nicer than Alden Capital. But in this case, you know, like I was talking about with Philip, the government let this thing kind of go. And it's not the first time that this has happened, especially in Chicago, like we mentioned. And it's unfortunate because we say like, oh boy, it's got a lot of work. It needs a lot of work. Well, if you kept it up, right? If there was, you know, more upkeep than was put into it over the years, we might be having a different conversation right now. So I think there's a failure on a few levels, but it's a state-owned, state-run building, right? So we look to the state, we look to our local government. If you're going to have this thing, then you can't just let it go to crap. You got to keep it up. And that's what's really, I think, frustrating. I guess it frustrates my, you know, my progressive nerves, because I like to think that government can be a vehicle to help people. But sometimes government fails, and we might be seeing that right now, the results of that.
You know, I think about it from just a resource standpoint, right? Like, you tear it down, that takes a lot of effort. It also takes effort to build up a new whatever that's going to be there.
And it won't look as cool.
It will not. It will not. What's the best? It's just a really expensive luxury that we'd like to have as a city. But
yeah,
the darndest thing is, it was our government that made it so expensive. Like the sticker price that we are all now looking at, or some benevolent billionaire is looking at, our local government, our state government is absolutely responsible for that ridiculous price tag.
And again, going back to the upkeep, this is more of just like how it's run. They try in their quest to save money. You can't go in there after 6 o'clock or on the weekends because it's a government building. It's pretty much shut down. And you think to yourself, could you open it up to tourism? And I know there are tours that go in there. I know that during the week. But like, I'd love to take my kids in there. I'll have to wait to the summertime, maybe, when I'm not teaching. But I'd love to take my kids there on a weekend. But I can't do it because it's closed. So people can't go check it out and kind of fall in love with it unless you're downtown during working hours. And maybe it's a little thing, Colin. It just frustrated me.
100%. 100%. There's, I mean, and, you know, obviously, if it was in a private owner's hands, you would be able to do stuff like that. You'd be able to maximize the facility beyond your standard government work hours. I get that. I know I'm not supposed to speak it into existence, so I won't, but that's what I think is going to happen.
Well, I won't miss the food court. The food court's kind of janky.
But it is the cheapest lunch in the loop.
Yeah, it is. It is that. We're going to send some positive vibes through the Thompson Center. And, hey, we got musical today. We had a couple music segments with the Secret History of Chicago Music, of course, and Jared Rabin. I thought Jared's pretty cool. I like his sound. And is May going to be kind of music month here on Outside the Loop?
I think it should be, because there are, one, as we demonstrated today, plenty of awesome local musicians who are rearing to get back out there to perform, and we should be there to listen to them with ears open wide. And there are, you know, a great number of venues that want to host said musicians and that need to kick their things back in gear, and we should be going out to them with arms open wide for drinks and apps and delicious bar food or whatever it is.
I can tell what Colin's thinking about these days.
You know, I have often said that I kind of did my live music thing. I went to so many concerts between the ages of 18 and 23 that I thought I would never go to a concert, because I went to three a week for all 5 years. But I could really go to a concert these days, Mike. It's been that kind of a year. Making music a priority in the month of May, Mike, I think that's a great idea. You have done it again, Mr. Genius.
Colin, what a great way, I think, to wrap up the program here. I want you to have a great week and maybe have some chicken wings with some spicy sauce. And if you can afford it, because like I said, prices are up, I want you to go forward with positive vibes.
I appreciate that. And to that end, I would say, try yourself a cauliflower wing. Try yourself a meat substitute wing. Go that route. I would do that.
All right, Colin. You should try it. Report back to us.
I'll bring over some cauliflower wings. I mean, number one, cauliflower is delicious if you season it up correctly. It's great. It's a very nice texture. It's quote-unquote meaty. It's great. You can apply it to anything. I should send you the recipe to this cauliflower and black bean taco thing that we do on the regular over here. It's very good.
Okay. I want that.
You have a great week. I want you to have a great week. Mike, I want you to have a great week. Mike, I can't say it enough. Have a great week.
We're going to have a great week. And you, the listener, you're going to have a great week, too. And that's the wrap party for Outside the Loop, show number 760. Wrap party. And that just about does it. Outside the Loop, show number 760, is all wrapped up just for you. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer. Thanks to Colin for producing the program today. Have a great week. I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop on 720 WGN.